Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What up? It's a Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. My guest today is one of the most insightful and thoughtful writers about the modern NBA game. He is Mike Prada. You know his work from SB Nation, where he spent many years. He's now a writer and editor at The Athletic, and he's got a fascinating new book out. It's called Spaced Out: How the NBA's Three-Point Revolution Changed Everything You Thought You Knew About Basketball. A lot's been written, of course, over the last decade about the three-point era, about pace and space, about small ball, about all these components that go into what we now know as the modern NBA game. Mike's book is, I think, the most comprehensive explanation that I have seen, taking us through all the various stages and players and teams and coaches who sparked this revolution, but also back to the seeds of a lot of this that are from prior eras. It's really fascinating, a great read and a great education on the game. Great conversation with Mike about that and some current NBA storylines. Before we get to that, a quick plug for another book from Sports Illustrated about the history of the Lakers. It's called The Greatest Show on Earth. I had the honor of writing the foreword for it. It features 15 stories from the pages of SI from the 60s through the present, covering all the Laker legends, Kareem and Magic and Wilt, Shaq, Kobe, LeBron, and of course written by some of the greatest sports writers of all time, Frank DeFord, Jack McCallum, Lee Jenkins, Chris Ballard, and others. It is now available for pre-order with a 30% discount. Go to triumphbooks.com, search for Greatest Show on Earth. There's also a direct link in the summary of this podcast, or you can type in a bit.ly link, bit.ly/Lakers75. When you get to checkout, use the discount code LAKERS30 and you'll get a 30% discount. Again, triumphbooks.com, search for The Greatest Show on Earth, enter discount code LAKERS30 for the 30% discount. Okay, my conversation with Mike Prada is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now very pleased to be joined by Mike Prada. Mike, welcome. Good to see you. How are you?
I'm good. Great to see you.
It's been a while. Have not seen you, bumped into you in any arenas anywhere. But I don't bump, like, it's just now the last several weeks that I've finally started to bump into people in arenas again, period. Because even though last year we were kind of back in NBA arenas, this feels like the first normal season. But good to see you virtually, at least. A tough day, obviously, for our country. I don't know where you stand in the Taylor Swift ticketing fiasco.
A lot of my coworkers are very upset today.
Yeah,
Let's just put it that way.
It's been a tough afternoon here at the Beck household. My daughter's a huge Swift fan. We took her, it was her first concert ever. It was like 5-6 years ago we took her to Taylor Swift out in Jersey. We were hoping to get these. Ticketmaster, you suck. I've had it. We're done. Bring back Ticketron is what I'm saying.
I can get behind that.
Pearl Jam had it right when they wanted to end the Ticketmaster monopoly. All right, end of editorial filibustering.
I agree with that as well. Great point.
it's bad, is what I'm saying. Great to see you. Congrats on the launch of the book Spaced Out, which we will discuss at length here in a moment. I like it so much that I have now, I believe it's either 4 or 5 copies.
Wow, thank you.
I don't.
Okay, so that takes up half of the sales right there. Thank you.
This is not me like sucking up trying to get high on your list of favorite NBA writers, but I'm not even sure how I ended up with 5. So I pre-ordered because I like to support my fellow writers out there. I did a pre-order months ago, forgot that I had pre-ordered. And then, of course, the promotional copies come before the ones you buy anyway. Yes. So when somebody reached out, they said, hey, we'll send you a copy. Yeah, please send me a copy. Somehow I ended up with like 3 or 4 of the advanced copies. So I didn't even pay for most of these, Mike. I'm sorry. I did pay for one.
One is more than a lot of people are paid for. I'll take that.
People go buy the book. All right. So before we jump into the book, let's just hit a couple quick things about where things stand in the NBA as you and I sit here on Thursday afternoon, where teams have played between 13 and 16 games. So that's 16% to 19% of the schedule, which is still small sample sizes, but enough to be significant and enough for some of our early concerns to be like serious concerns. Here's how weird things are. So the Warriors are 6-9, of course, and winless on the road still. The Trailblazers lead the West at 10-4. The Jazz, who were supposed to be tanking, are tied with Portland for the most wins in the West at 10. And the Jazz have the 3rd most wins in the NBA behind Boston and Milwaukee. The Kings have the best record in the state of California by mere percentage points over the Clippers. But still, the Kings have the best record in California.
I believe the Cavaliers have the number 1 point differential in the league. Or at least they did until they lost.
Well, the 5-game losing streak might have wrecked that. But
yeah.
And the Pacers are a half game better than the Sixers. The Pacers are full game up on Miami. So shit is weird, is what I'm saying.
Very weird.
Maybe this explains the Ticketmaster Taylor Swift fiasco. I don't know. It's all related somehow. Which one of these things to you, Mike, is most striking? Is there any one thing that might explain it all? Is there any one of these that is your favorite? Like, what is intriguing it amidst the weirdness of the early season?
Where to begin? It has been a strange one. The first thought I had, and we were kind of BSing about this before the podcast, is that isn't this kind of the NBA Adam Silver has always wanted? You know, maybe. This is where everybody, there's parity. If you're well managed, you can kind of climb quickly.
I like the scare quotes. You can't see this, folks, on a podcast, but Preda put up the air quotes with the fingers. That was great with the well managed part. Yes.
Yeah. Because the Sacramento Kings very well managed. So that's why they're. it's interesting to see like kind of everybody clumped together like this. This is very much the football model. And I think it's kind of funny that this happened in a year where everyone was supposed to be tanking for Victor Wembanyama. And, you know, it's still a little early to figure out what it all means, but I do sort of wonder, and this maybe ties into the book, and this is just a half thought I've had. Is there something about how maybe the game has reached like kind of this stage where everybody kind of knows this is how we're supposed to play, and now we're kind of innovating off that there are players who are entering the league younger who like kind of know what they're doing more. I mean, a lot of these teams that are surprising are kind of doing it with young players who have really surged. I'm thinking of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Tyrese Halliburton, maybe not necessarily some of the Jazz players, but some of these teams that are surprising us are kind of these young players who are a little bit different, a little bit more, I guess, to steal a quote from like a book, the book, spaced out native. And I just wonder if like maybe we've reached this point where like kind of now the teams that are most creative are the ones that are prospering. And it's just a half thought I've had, but it's definitely, I mean, I certainly didn't expect it. So, you know, it's just interesting to see.
I think maybe another aspect of this, and some of these things are just, they're really hard to quantify, but you know, we've had an ongoing conversation amidst, you know, NBA folks over the last few years that it does feel like this is maybe the most talent the league has ever had. And, you know, even like when we talk about the Pacers overachieving early on or surprising us early on, part of that is because Bennedict Mathurin has been fantastic. And, you know, it's not often in this league, in this era, where guys can come in as rookies and be that impactful. They sometimes put up numbers, but they don't necessarily contribute to winning right off. And he is, and you combine him with Tyrese Halliburton, and now you've already got one of the stronger backcourts in the NBA, and they're really young. And, you know, they're already a team that you think, wow, maybe they're ahead of schedule. Now, you know, they could be one Russell Westbrook and two draft picks trade away from having two fewer stars on their roster, or two fewer starters on their roster, you know, if they do the much discussed healed Miles Turner deal. But for now, at least, like, they're actually competitive and interesting. And yeah, maybe it is just that young guys are a little bit more ready, or maybe there's just more talent all the way around in the league. I don't know. And, you know, to your point, like, yeah, during the lockout of 2011, which I remember fondly, that was the constant message from Adam Silver and David Stern at that time was, you know, 30 teams, if well managed, blah, 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 blah. And I don't think we're to a point where we can say 30 teams are well managed.
No.
There's always a few we could point to and say, I have no idea what you're doing, and you don't seem to either. But there does seem to be, you know, whether it's the downward pressure of the luxury tax and the repeater tax, whether it's an influx of talent, whether it is maybe the three-point era, which you wrote about at length in your book, which we will discuss in a minute, maybe that has become a great equalizer as we've gotten to a certain critical mass here of everybody playing, not the same style, but at least everybody being in on the idea that, oh, if we don't shoot a lot of threes, we've got no chance.
Yeah.
I don't know. There probably is no through line, but, well, you know, it is interesting.
One thing I would say, and I think that the last year's finals and last year's season kind of started to prove this, and then you also look at who's, like, at the bottom of the standings right now. It's a team like the Lakers. I guess the Nets have been a little bit better, but they're still kind of down there and struggling. A lot of these so-called super teams that were built around, like, two or three great players, and, like, it doesn't really matter who 4 through 15 is on the roster, are the ones that are struggling, whereas you see a lot of the teams that are thriving are ones that do have a lot of depth. And that bucks a lot of NBA history right there. But I do think there is a connection where the nature of the game today, and this is something I talk a little bit about in the book, it is much more of a game that's based on what your collective shape is and, you know, the choreography of your movement. And there's a lot more sort of multiplayer interactions and, you know, context surrounding kind of how these teams run their plays. It's not really a one-on-one game anymore. And we have reached the point where it's not quite at the point where soccer is, where, like, they say soccer is like a weak link game, whereas basketball is a strong link game, but it's more like that. And so some of these teams, particularly these teams that are kind of on the other end of the, like, trade star for picks kind of moment, where they now accumulate a few of these young guys together, they have, like, a more cohesive whole than the sum of their parts, in a way that a team like the Lakers, or a team like the Nets, or a team, some of these other teams, frankly, even a team like the Warriors at this point, you know, with how bad their bench is, they don't have it. The one, I always like to say, 1 + 1 sometimes can equal, like, 1/2 in the NBA, and sometimes it can equal 1,000. And I feel like the teams that are kind of have that critical mass of interesting players that are all working together are thriving more now in the way the game is played than they would have even as recently as 2 years ago. And, you know, maybe combine that with just sort of the other reason for a super team backlash, and you might be getting some of these, like, Utah is a team that's just a bunch of interesting parts. And I think in the past, the lack of a hierarchy would have been a major weakness, but the style of play now, at least for now, is making it so that you can leverage all those different people off each other a lot better with how much they move and cut and shoot threes and kind of the interchangeability of some of their parts. And now the very thing that was a weakness in the past is now a weapon. So I was sort of thinking that a little bit last year when he sort of, I don't think Steph or Jason Tatum were among the top eight players in the regular season last year or so. And yet their teams advanced far. Obviously, Steph played like a great player in the finals. And that's pretty rare. And we might be getting to that point where being like top heavy is a major problem in a way that, because of the way the game is played, that it wasn't in the past. And that, I think, dovetails with what Adam Silver wanted.
Yes.
Salary structure wise. So it's still early, but it is interesting to see who is thriving and who is not.
And listen, there might be a hard, there is a hard ceiling, I would say, on a team like the Utah Jazz, right? And they might, they may well finish this season, probably will finish this season with a better record than the Lakers. And one team has all the star power and one team has virtually none. And if Lowry Markkanen makes the all-star game, then we can amend that statement. But it's still not this, you know, you could be an all-star and still not have star power. It's not the same thing as the magnetism of a LeBron or Anthony Davis or Russell Westbrook. But, you know, chemistry matters. As you point out, depth matters. Being able to fill out a roster matters. And maybe that is the ultimate antidote. I mean, maybe this is just kind of a natural order of things where the universe kind of self-corrects. So when we wondered for years about, well, what is the antidote to the Miami Heat super team or then the Warriors super team, the Cavs super team, as teams were just you know, grabbing every star they could and just jamming them together and hoping for the best. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But for everybody else who couldn't get those kinds of super teams, or couldn't bring them to their markets because they were smaller markets, the question was, well, how do we keep up? Well, it kind of took care of itself in a way. And I've noted this about the last couple of NBA champions even. The Warriors, this version of the Warriors was not a super team. It was Steph and a bunch of really well-calibrated role players around him, because Draymond is not really a star anymore of the same level, and neither is Klay Thompson, and obviously Kevin Durant's gone. And if you go back a year, well, all right, Giannis, Middleton, Drew Holiday, but that's not exactly a big three along the long lines of LeBron, Bosch, and Wade.
So, I would say, and even Phoenix, the team they played against, was certainly not that type of team.
These were ensembles. And so we actually are in like a little mini era of ensembles kind of winning the day. And I think that's healthy for the NBA on the whole. And meanwhile, some super teams, notably Brooklyn and LA, are crashing hard due to things that are not so much about talent or payroll necessarily as they are about those things, plus some age issues, chemistry issues, just chaos issues in Brooklyn.
I mean, the teams don't fit together. I mean, like, that's, I think, part of the problem. It's much more. So I think one of the things that's happened, I mean, beyond three pointers, what this book is really about is kind of a spacing revolution and how we're just basically using more of the court than before. Combine that with, I think, the most important thing that happened over the last 20, 25 years in basketball on the court was getting rid of illegal defense in 2001. It basically, over time, has institutionalized defense as really a five-man operation. Whereas before, I mean, the offense could go where you want, where they wanted, but defenders couldn't. So you could understand how the game was built around one-on-one play when that was the best way to, you know, attack a defense that had to either double team or not double team. The natural evolution of that that has brought us to this point, I think, is that defense is much more, even more than it ever has been. And this is kind of manifested a little bit in like kind of the talk about the rise of zone, but I think it's even deeper than that. Defenses like are much more five-man units that move collectively on a string than ever before, and they're much more aggressive at helping and recovering and helping and recovering, because that was kind of how they realized they had to cover all this extra space that they never had to cover before. Like, one person could not do that. And so that was sort of the reaction. But the effect of that is that if defense is a five-man operation, your offense has got to present five threats at the right time and the right movement patterns to be able to capitalize. And if you have a team that has two great players, but they're two players that the defense doesn't have to worry about, or two players that, you know, don't move or stationary or just not really a part of the game or a specialist in any way, you know, it's just a lot easier to load up to the stars than it ever was before. And so we've reached the point, I think, and this is what I think might happen down the road. The very definition of what makes a superstar, this is the subject of chapter three of the book, is totally changing. It's not just about how well you do directly. It's the points you score, the assists you have, the rebounds you you get, and just the direct impact of like kind of I have the ball a lot and then I pass and something happens. It's also kind of the shadow impact, the indirect sort of ability that you make the life slightly easier for your teammate and vice versa. And I think that's being reflected now in these ensembles. We call them ensembles, but in some ways to be a star is to be a great part of the whole now. I know it sounds like a little like abstract, but I think that's starting to happen where like, it's not, Steph Curry is not great because he shoots threes really well or dribbles really well or finishes or whatever. He's great because he sucks two players to him 35 feet from the hoop and everybody else gets to play 4-on-3. Like by not doing stuff, he is more valuable. And I think there are a lot of ways that the stars and role players have to interact now as part of a whole that is just changing the way teams are built and teams, what it means to be a superstar.
Yeah. And it's an interesting point. And I like the fact that you referenced the rule change with illegal defense, because it's such an arcane thing to think about. And even the phrase, even the term illegal defense is just
so
like,
weird, right?
It's so weird. It's funny. So I won't name names, though I'm sure he wouldn't mind. But when I was working at Bleacher Report, and I had very young teammates there, one of whom was an NBA fan. And I mentioned something about the rule changes back in the early 2000s and illegal defense. And he said, well, wait a minute, what was that?
Right.
And I actually had, well, see, it used to be back in the day, and a lot of people, you know, it's because time is funny this way. It goes by quick. You don't realize there's an entire generation who have come up never having been aware that the NBA at one point in time, everybody had to basically play man-to-man. There was no zone. Zone was illegal. And there was this phenomenon of, which the NBA then moved to correct, one guy could, or two guys would be on one side of the court on the strong side, because the other four would go to the other side and you had to go with your man. And so now you have eight players standing around watching while Iverson dribbles the ball to death to take his man off the dribble, or Kobe takes him off the dribble, or Steve Francis takes his man off the dribble. And it was that mind-numbing isolation play that the NBA was trying to get rid of. The funny part is that within the last several years, we had ISO came storming back, and now we have this heliocentric era where Harden, less so now, but Harden is at his peak, and Westbrook at his peak, and Luka now are putting up usage rates that Michael Jordan never did, that Kobe Bryant never did, that the all-time greats of the past never did. And so there's an irony there where there still is a lot of isolation play, but I also think that, to your point, the best use of a supreme talent is actually to leverage all these opportunities for your teammates. And the teams that are doing it well then can win championships. And Giannis has done it, and Steph has done it, and Harden has not, I would say.
Yeah. And we'll see about Luka, I suppose.
And we'll see about Luka, but I don't think what he's doing is, it's awesome, but it's not, I don't think it's sustainable. And I think, again, I think there's a ceiling on the Mavericks' success with him doing that much, while even acknowledging it's probably on a night-to-night basis what he has to do, because he just doesn't have the talent around him. And that's the thing, you know, talent is still determinative on some level in this league, even as you and I sit here talking about how awesome it is that teams can just have great depth and great chemistry and win that way. But you got to have the guy, and sometimes you got to have two of the guys. Let's jump into the book a little bit again. So it's the book is spaced out, How the NBA's Three-Point Revolution Changed Everything You Thought You Knew About Basketball. I liked this as kind of a companion piece to Kirk Goldsberry's Sprawl Ball of a few years back. With, I think the two of these together, like, explain the era and the roots of the era very well. And yours goes far deeper into kind of bringing out some of the things that were going on in the 80s that explain what came in like the mid 2000s.
Which 80s, the 1880s or the 1980s? Because there's a little bit on the 1880s too.
that's true. You went really deep into the history books there. Naismith never accounted for pace and space though.
No.
So just as a quick reference point here, and you've got a lot of this stuff in the book, but I just was doing a quick and dirty look on Basketball Reference before we got on. Here's how quickly things have changed. Because I often think in my own head about, well, this era started with Mike D'Antoni and Steve Nash and the Suns and 7 seconds or less in the mid-2000s. But the acceleration of the last 7 years is really what's striking. So the Warriors are leading the league right now at 41 three-point attempts per game, which is just kind of mind-boggling. The year they won their first title in 2014-15, they were averaging 27 a game. Let's say
and that was like the And that was like leading the league.
Yeah. And that, they were second in the league, I think, to Houston.
Okay.
But that's only 7 years ago. It's 7 years. The Warriors went from being a team that we thought was predicated on 3-point shooting, the Splash Brothers, but they averaged 27 threes a game. Now they average 41. That same year, 2014-15, the Rockets led the league with 32.7 3-point attempts per game. That would rank 20th today.
Yeah.
Again, this is not a 20-year comparison. This is 7 years.
And the Warriors would rank last, I believe.
I didn't look up that one, but yeah, I'm sure you're right. The Hawks right now are last at 28.4 per game.
Yeah.
And that would have been second in 2014-15. Right.
We're talking like 8 years, yeah, 7 years.
It's crazy. Why did it? So we know about a lot of the roots, and you go into a lot of the roots in detail in your book. You explain where 7 seconds or less comes into play, where Don Nelson's We Believe Warriors come into play, mm-hmm, where rules changes come into play. There's all these interesting inflection points, and I want to ask you about that too. But first, why are we seeing such an acceleration over the last even just half decade or so? In particular, is it just everybody rushing to catch up? Is it just that the math became so determinative and we aren't in an analytics age? Like, why is it accelerating so quickly now? Because the leaps from 1979-80 when the three-point shot's introduced to 1990 or 90 to 2000, 2000 to 2000, like
it's
nothing
like
compares to what's happened in the last five, six, 7 years.
So I think there are two ways I can answer that question. The first is sort of from a more philosophical human history perspective, which is, generally speaking, big technological advances proceed in spikes. You've got gradual change, and then somebody has this like kind of brilliant new idea, and then it just, in a very short stretch, it just spikes. And then it kind of, that's the new normal, and then it levels off, and then it spikes again. I mean, just think about like social media, you know, as a concept, or cell phones, you know, how quickly that went from, you know, what the hell is this thing to like, this is just a normal part of our lives. And it,
yes,
you know, that is generally, I think, how human history proceeds. In the NBA example, I think all the things that you said are the answer, and they all kind of mushroom together and create this exponential effect that is, I think, evident in what the Warriors were able to accomplish and how that changed the league. All of these things were happening at once. There was an analytics movement that was saying three is more than two. There was a burgeoning kind of pace and space movement that was very much illustrated by the Suns. And I tell this story about how I think the Suns of D'Antoni kind of split into like a two factions, almost like kind of two sects of a religion, where the Warriors are kind of the more, for lack of a better word, the art sect, and the Rockets are kind of the more like science, prosaic, industrial sect. And it's their rivalry that they kind of constantly are bashing their heads against the wall against each other. But the other 30 teams is like, well, I can take a little bit from here. We can stand further away like the Rockets, but actually we need to cut a lot like the Warriors, and we need to move the, you know, and they collected like forces a leap forward. You know, you had to catch up to them. But I think the biggest thing is that all of these things kind of, for whatever reason, kind of come to a head right at one moment and create all of the conditions to cause this. I mean, there were people well before Mike D'Antoni who said you should play faster and kind of play more loosely.
Yeah.
There were people before these teams that said we should shoot the ball more from three. There are people, Don Nelson in particular, who say, well, why do we have to have a center look like a center, or a point guard look like a point guard? I mean, I tell the story about Billy Knight in the book, you know, the old Hawks GM who had this 6'8" fetish, really. You know, there are people that did that. There are people that, you know, were pick and roll heavy rather than isolation heavy. It's just that all of these forces kind of came together at the exact moment that they needed to, and around, I think, again, the mid-2000s. And it's through the collection of all of them kind of exploding together that creates this spike. And I guess that's the best way I can describe it, is that it's kind of all of these happening at once. If they each happened in isolation, you wouldn't have seen all this stuff happen, this profound transformation. And the big point I would stress, too, is that because everybody's shooting threes more, what it has really done, and this is what really the book is about as much as the threes, is that it's doubled the court, essentially. So players are standing, the borders of a typical half-court possession or just a typical possession are essentially twice as long, but you haven't added more players to fill that space. So it just changes everything that you would want to do. You know, how does shooting work? How does moving work? How does defense work? How does dribbling work? How does all these things that we kind of accept? It's like you basically doubled the service. So like it's a different game when you play the same sport over twice as large a space. And that's kind of what ended up happening.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book, you talk about this as optimizing space, that what this era is really about is optimizing space. And then you note at one point, too, that if you were to, you know, pull up a clip on YouTube and drew, you know, boxes around like where the players are, or collections of players are, then do the same thing with like a game clip from 1985 or whenever, it would be like dramatically evident. It would just be so obvious. It would look like, you know, it would look like a different game. But to your point, it's like we're using more of the court now. Mm-hmm. And that changes everything that you can then do in those spaces. As you say, as you wrote, you've optimized the space.
Right. There's to the point about sort of wrong person, wrong time type of thing. We're talking about how it all had to happen at the right time. There was a guy in the 70s, Howard Hobson, who first invented the three-pointer, who wrote a letter to Larry O'Brien. This is right when there was a debate about, do we want the 3-point shot or not? He wrote a letter to Larry O'Brien saying, you know, if you want to stop fighting in the NBA, you can't let these guys play in a phone booth. You know, you have to create a 3-point line to force them out. Like, that's the solution. And you look back at that now and it's like, God, isn't that super obvious? But back then, it just didn't quite land until it did all of a sudden, and then everybody kind of realized what the deal was. And so it really is. It sort of hides in plain sight because your TV screen is the same like size as it would have. Well, maybe not.
Oh, no, actually, they're much, much larger.
Yes, but you know, if you watch a classic game on an old TV,
yes,
but you don't realize that the camera is way further pulled back until you actually kind of really look at it.
Yeah. Yes. And actually, because we have smart TVs, you could pull up the 1980s games on YouTube on your smart TV and then pull up a modern game and look at how different the court looks even that way.
Yeah.
The graininess notwithstanding. If you were to tell the story of the modern era or of this revolution through one team, what would it be? Because I'm thinking like there's a version of this story where it's about Mike D'Antoni's Suns in the mid 2000s. There's a version of this where it's Steph Curry's Warriors. There's a version of this where it's explained through the Miami Heat, starting with the second year of the
right.
Wade Bosch LeBron era, and Bosch becoming the quote unquote small ball center and pace and space and Shane Battier at the four. Like there's all these different versions of this. I mean, there's even a version of this where you could point to the Dwight Howard, Stan Van Gundy, Orlando Magic that make the finals, right?
Where one of the teams, one of the teams that was not mentioned a lot in the book, and I felt
they're oft forgotten, but kind of an important, you know, as all of our markers in the road, they're kind of one of them. Who do you think explains where we are best?
I think the answer is something I said earlier. I think it's the Warriors-Rockets rivalry. You cannot separate the two of them out from each other.
Yeah.
It's that they thrust the league forward. And, you know, you connect them to, like, the Suns because they had people – I mean, there are members of the Suns that ended up making their way to both franchises. But to me, if you had to limit it to kind of one or two teams or one storyline, it really is that rivalry. I mean, I think the 2018 – Western Conference Finals is the most important modern NBA series out there. I mean, that series is, to me, the big inflection point because you had, again, one team that played very differently, kind of being dragged into that style, and this other team that, you know, got them so close to there playing this kind of one-on-one game, and then suddenly they missed 27 threes, and then the next year the Warriors gloat about how you can't take step-back threes and win the playoffs at that Sloan Conference. And to me, that is kind of the inflection point of the NBA as we know it right here. And to your point, I mean, you could tell this story a lot of different ways. And I think for me, it was really important as I was writing this to try to make sure I had a self-contained point. And I think I immediately kind of identified like kind of 2014 to 2022 as that point, with all this other stuff kind of feeding into it.
Yeah.
And then to me, it was important to kind of have, again, the device. And I knew that I would leave out or give short shrift to some teams like the Stan Van Gundy Magic that, you know, were there and were very important, kind of almost inventing the stretch four position that soon became the stretch five position and all of that. But to me, it's very much the essence is that Warriors-Rockets rivalry.
Yeah.
The one that I think is actually a little underrated that I actually use as a device for an entire chapter talking about pick and roll defense is Milwaukee. You know, going from Jason Kidd to Mike Budenholzer to what they have now, they very much mirrored kind of the league's kind of battle for how do we defend all this extra space, you know, where you start, they kind of go within reverse first. It's like, do we just like get really long and trap all the time? Oh, that doesn't work. Well, let's kind of play drop. And oh, that doesn't work. Now we have to switch a little bit more. And oh, that does it. But like now it's kind of all of these things. So I actually do think that they're kind of an underrated, important team. But ultimately, it really is Rockets, Warriors, that rivalry, art, science, you know, both of them kind of colonizing more parts of the court, shooting more threes, having the same general goal, but just vehemently disagreeing on how to go about it. It's that battle that kind of makes thrust the league forward.
I like that. And I like that it's that they are kind of two sides of the same coin in a way, just very different philosophies. And then of course there's the, you know, the question that can never be answered, which is, you know, if not for some injuries and where does that go? What if the Rockets win? What if the Rockets win the championship? You know, there's a sliding doors moment for both franchises and the league there. I wanted to ask you too about just, you know, because of the rise of the three-pointer means all of the annoying conversations and debates about, you know, death of post play, death of, the presumed death of the mid-range and a lot of hand-wringing about that. And then, you know, then there was a backlash where every time somebody was thriving in the mid-ranges, it's like, aha, see, mid-range isn't dead after all. And it's like, well, nobody really said it was dead. Kirk Goldsberry might have said it was dead at one point, but Kirk likes going with a little hyperbole.
I have a theory about this, like, whole mid, this, like, a meta conversation about this that I put in a footnote that I'm curious to know what you think of it. I think the reason the mid-range shot gets so much attention is that the people who are commentating on basketball tend to be the people that would have been allowed to shoot mid-range shots today. You know, they're better. They're the superstars. It's as if, like, kind of you had 100 DeMar DeRozans commenting on basketball. So that's why it gets undue attention.
I mean, there may be something to that. I think we also just have kind of a tendency toward traditionalism.
That's definitely true.
And not just among the pundit class or ex-players and broadcasters, but also I think even among older fans, right? Like there's always this kind of feeling like, well, the version of this that I grew up on, whether that's music, whether it's basketball, whether it's, you know, whatever, is always the preferred way. It's familiar. It's right. Like we're going too far from this. And so I think that applies to a lot of things.
To your point though, I think what I think has happened is that we have taken for granted how radical a change this has been.
Yeah.
Right. So it's to your point about sort of wanting things to be the way it was. I think the reason you didn't hear as much about this, like kind of maybe 20 years ago about like, oh, I want the game to be like it was in the 80s or something or in the 70s, is that we literally have doubled the court. So like it is a more profound change over the last few years. So if I'm somebody who has played this game at an incredibly high level, is now being paid very handsomely to talk about this game that I know like the back of my hand, and then the game all of a sudden over 8 years just becomes a different game, yeah, I'd be pretty confused about how to explain it too.
Yeah. I wonder about this. So I was trying to figure out how to define this, and I finally just jotted this down as the Giannis, Ben Simmons, DeMar DeRozan, Russell Westbrook quandary. They're all very different, but it's the quandary of like guys who either are or were great. We're waiting for you to resurface, Ben Simmons, but without the 3-point shot. And so if anybody was wondering like, well, is the 3-point shot now so determinative that you can't build a team around a great player who's great in from everywhere else? Well, Giannis has answered that because he's still shooting threes in like the 20 something percentages or maybe low 30s at times.
Yeah.
Ben Simmons, we all went, you know, if we have to remember who Ben Simmons was 2-3 years ago, Ben Simmons at that time, it was, oh my God, he's amazing. He's one of one. And he can guard all five positions, and he's an incredible playmaker and passer, and he can get to the rack, and he does everything except shoot the three, but shouldn't he shoot the three? And then DeMar DeRozan, phenomenal in the mid-range, and like carbon copy moves at times of you know, the Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan type mid-range turnaround jumpers, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. Russell Westbrook, if only he would either just not take those threes or at least make some of the, like, so we've had this hand-wringing about all these guys in different ways. Giannis won a championship without needing to be a great three-point shooter, but he at least takes them. DeRozan, as you point out in the book, has been like defiant about like, no, screw you guys. This is who I am. I don't need to do this. Yeah. And we could argue either way there, right? Because you could say, well, the Raptors could only get so far with DeRozan as their centerpiece, and the Bulls have only been able to get so far. But maybe that's just because DeRozan's just not a great enough talent, period. Right. Westbrook, there's other things wrapped up. I don't know. Like, I don't know where I'm going with this, Mike. I think there's been this interesting debate about all these guys. To be a supreme player in today's league, do you have to either A, be really good at the three, or B, at least be willing, as Giannis is, to take it to quote unquote keep defenses honest? What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think there's let me answer first the philosophical sort of like kind of big picture question, which is just, if you're really good at something, you're probably really good at it because you break the mold. But of course, if everybody tried to break the mold, then you wouldn't. How could everybody be breaking the mold? So I do think that like there is sort of this kind of the exception that proves the rule type of thing going on here with some of these great players. But I actually think like kind of to drill deeper on this question, what I think has really happened, and this is something that Don Nelson kind of understood and why I wanted to talk about him and why I talk about how I think the word positionalist is kind of misleading in the book, and how I think it's sort of shorthand that like kind of obscures as much as it illuminates. And that is, it's more of a positional revolution type of thing where you're now taking skill sets that you need, whether they come in the form of tall guys, short guys, medium-sized guys, or whatever. And you're saying, as a unit, as a five-man unit, we need to have as many of these bases covered as possible. And you're now opening yourself up to different means of how to get that. So it may be that if you're a seven-footer, you don't have to be a big man. You can play like a guard, or you can play like Bruce Brown or Gary Payton or some of those sort of guards that play like bigs. What matters ultimately is not whether individual players are shooting the three, although obviously that helps. It's that you have a structure that supports one player who's really good at all the other stuff, but isn't a great shooter. You have to support him with the right structure around him. It's more about how the whole fits together, more so than anything. And so I think in general, yeah, as you cannot build a team without three-point threats, because ultimately you need to give the defense a reason to guard that spot space way out there. If you suck at shooting, they just won't guard your space, that space out there. You are effectively shrinking the court for yourself. You are saying, everybody else gets to play on a court that's this big, but I'm going to play on a court that's this big. So you need it as a team. Does that mean that every individual player needs to do it? I think it depends on how you construct the whole roster. And so you look at, I mean, part of the challenge of Simmons in Philly was as much about Simmons but it was also about Simmons and Embiid as a tandem, because if Simmons is going to be the player that doesn't shoot and needs to drive space to drive, it puts Embiid in a position where he can't be his best self. And, yeah. You know, then Jimmy Butler kind of gets thrown in the mix and that whole challenge. So is that a problem with Ben Simmons? Is that a problem with Embiid, or is that a problem with the whole? Sometimes these sorts of things get kind of placed onto the player. And, you know, Milwaukee, I think with Giannis, I mean, they do have a lot of shooting elsewhere. They've got a 7-foot giant nicknamed Splash Mountain. And you see the impact he has being healthy this year versus last year. You know, you need those two guys kind of in tandem together to support Giannis. Whereas you look at Westbrook, I mean, Westbrook has clearly lost like many steps and doesn't realize what he is, but he's also on a team that like has no shooting around him. So it's a lot of it is the whole that kind of adds up. So sometimes I think we have these conversations about individual players when we really should be having them about structures, but it's a lot more complicated to talk about a structure. It's much easier to sort of talk about the players, and it's not wrong to talk about the players. It's just sort of a slightly different thing. So to me, so much of the game now is about the structure making sense collectively and shifting in the right way, the right types of movements, and more so than ever. And I think it's, you need the right players for the structure, but ultimately what matters is you take the players and you build the structure around the players. And I think in the past it was so much, you have this structure, that's what's supposed to be, and then the players have to fill it. And that's the big revolution right there, more so than positionless or three-point shooting. So it's a bit of a long-winded way to answer the question, but I think combined with that and just like kind of, again, the exception often proves the rule in these sorts of situations. Like, the very, very best players are not models. They are exceptions.
Yeah. Which brings us to the positional, this debate over positional definitions also. And you say positional revolution. People have talked about it being a positionless era. I prefer the term positional fluidity.
Yes.
Which I think is kind of in the same zone. But, because it's not so much that the game is positionless.
I agree with you. I think you're right.
Yeah, I don't know what Jokic is, but he's definitely, like, if we're still applying the old terms, if you want to say he's a point center or even the point guard who happens to be 7 feet, well, that's fine. But you know that on defense, he's going to be standing in the paint. There's this old, you know, the old basketball guys will always tell you, you are what you guard, right? Which I really never liked that definition either. It's a little bit too limiting also. And also, as you were just talking about a few minutes ago, like, playing defense in today's NBA that's not even really one-on-one anymore either. You know,
I think that phrase is almost reflects how defense took a while to catch up to offense. Because if you say you are what you guard, it implies that, like, kind of where you guard is one-dimensional. But actually, what I think defenses have started to figure out is, like, we can't be one dimensional to stop these offenses.
Yeah, and look, I mean, you know, there are we saw in his Houston years where Harden actually became pretty good at being a physical post defender. So sometimes he was guarding, like, power forwards or even centers. It didn't make him a power forward or a center. Maybe the position titles are just completely useless at this point. It's funny because I think about this, and you touch on some of these things as you go along. But one of the things that's always, like, kind of bothered me is, like, Magic Johnson was called a point guard. He was just a big point guard at 6'8", but LeBron has always been called a small forward. But LeBron has essentially been the point guard of every team he's ever played on, in my mind. But they've always had a point guard who looked like Mario Chalmers or Damon Jones or Delonte West. Like, there was always a small guy. And the reason is because you still want, for the most part, unless you've got a Ben Simmons or a Giannis or somebody who can guard all five positions, you're still looking for a 6-footer to guard the other 6-footer and a 7-footer to guard the other 7-footer and some guys in between to guard the other guys in between.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Right? So the funny thing is, like, yes, these labels are in some ways feel obsolete when you have Jokic doing point guard things as a 7-footer and when you have Giannis doing just Giannis things as a 7-footer. But it still matters because if one team decides to play a really good player who is 6'2", you're probably not putting your 7-footer on him, even if you had 5 7-footers who could all handle and shoot, right? Like, I don't know.
I do have this theory that more teams should put their center on Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, but yes, you're probably right. Like, I also thought that the Jazz biggest error was they should have put Rudy Gobert directly on Kawhi, but that's a whole separate conversation.
That's a whole separate conversation.
Here's what I would say. I think there are skills that are point guardish, skills that are shoot and guardish, skills that are, like, all these positions. What Nikola Jokic is really, if you really think about it, he's a point guard when he's here, a center when he's here, a power forward when he's here, a shooting guard when he's here, and he just sort of shifts to, like, if you really think about what it means to be a position, like, originally positions were just positions on the floor, like, where you were on the floor. So if you apply that sort of literally rather than sort of say, like, a position has to have these attributes, it's more like kind of where do we actually put our players on the floor. there is still a structure. It just kind of is shifting all throughout a possession.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I think that's kind of what's happened, is that positionality is multidimensional. I mean, if you really want to kind of be prosaic about it, Michael Jordan, when he played in the triangle offense, was what? If you dribbled the ball up, he was a point guard. And then he would cut to the corner, and then he was a small forward. And then he would go, they would swing around, he'd go in the post, and then suddenly he's the center. We just can't. We just call him a shooting guard because it's just simpler.
I thought about this as I was reading the book. The very fact that Phil Jackson's offense, you know, Tex Winter's offense, you know, Sam Barry's offense, whoever, but it's the triangle offense was in some ways, I don't know if Phil ever used this term, but kind of positionless. It was, you filled spots on the floor, and then as the offense moved, as the defense reacted and you reacted, you filled other spots. And so, to your point,
I would argue it's like most positional, if you think literally, because it's like
you're occupying
certain positions. Yes.
Right. But in basketball, but it didn't fit the point guard, shooting guard, small forward, power forward, center thing.
Absolutely.
It was right. And also he liked having a two guard front, which meant he never needed a quote unquote true point guard, whatever that was, right? It would be Ron Harper and Scottie Pippen, or it would be, you know, Derek Fisher and Kobe Bryant. Like, Derek Fisher wasn't even a prototypical point guard except by height. So we've often already had versions of this without making up fancy terms about a positionless era. It's just, there are various versions of it. Even, you know, when D'Antoni was in Phoenix, his thing was like, just give me five guys who can all, like, you know, handle and pass and shoot, and I'll be happy. I don't care what size they are or where it. So there's always been elements of this.
That's the thing that I think has really changed, is that it's just you had to divorce positions from size ultimately.
Yeah.
And that's the big change. And so I tell the story in that chapter of Billy Knight, who in some ways is like, he said, like, just give me 5, 6, 8 basketball players. But what he almost was kind of creating a bigger problem than he was solving, because all he could see was, I need 6, 8 guys. And he never thought about what skills the 6, 8 guys actually,
or whether they were any good.
Were they any good? And more importantly, how did they work together?
Okay. Right? So here's a funny thing. All right. So Billy Knight, everybody would agree, not the greatest job in the world that he did with the Hawks at the time. And he famously drafted Marvin Williams because he was like 6'8", 6'9". Over Chris Paul and Darren Williams. But he kind of did see the future, because isn't that really what the Raptors are doing now?
So I don't think so. No, actually. See, this is actually the point I make in the book, is that I think this reading that he saw the future is flawed. Because all Billy Knight could see was the size of the player.
Well, all right, the abstract. But
the Raptors
are doing that, but just smarter. Yes.
But they're doing it, but they're building around skills. I mean, Chris Boucher and Pascal Siakam and Scottie Barnes and OG Anunoby, although perhaps less so, they don't play the same way. They are the same size.
Yes.
The new rookie they drafted, Koloko, Precious Achiuwa. And maybe to some degree, like, all those players kind of have to have the skills, and it's just a matter of whether – it's not that they all have these skills, but they need to kind of show certain ones at certain times, and that's kind of how the structure works. But I would say, like, even Toronto does not think skill first, size second. Now, it sort of plays out – but I think this is actually, like, an interesting distinction. Would Masai Ujiri have passed on Chris Paul?
No.
And I think the reason he wouldn't have is because he wouldn't have said, we need a 6'8 guy. He would have said, well, we could do some playmaking.
Right. He's not dogmatic about it. But the problem with what Billy Knight did was he was being dogmatic about, like, the idea that, like, I just want size.
Right.
I'm being a little glib about the comparison, but it's
superficially correct. I agree.
Well, but there is this idea. The part that Billy Knight had almost right is that if you did have a bunch of 6'8 guys who all had skill, who could all dribble, pass, shoot, that team would be a monster to try to guard and monster to as a defense, because of the amount of height and length and probably athleticism to go with it. And that is, in the abstract, what the Raptors have put together is a bunch of interchangeable guys who are long and athletic, not all identical, but all
high. By
the
way, where did the Raptors finish in half-court offense last year? Pretty bad.
Was it?
It was pretty bad. So, I mean, a team like that has weaknesses.
They're young. They're evolving. You know.
You know, I think, And it's challenging, of course, because like what works on defense doesn't work on offense and all these sorts of things. But yeah, I mean, it's just players aren't pigeonholed now, I think is kind of the big thing.
Yes. Which is great.
Yeah. Right? And I think almost in a weird way, Billy Knight pigeonholed his own kind of futurism. You know what I mean?
By trying to be unconventional, he became too conventional or something like that?
Basically, yes. He almost created he created a more rigid positional structure than what already existed. So, yeah, I think it's just, I mean, this is all like kind of, this discussion is like kind of in the book. It's just, I thought it was an interesting parallel to just positions are not size based anymore. You know, the skill comes first, and obviously they're defensively like size and skill are very intertwined, but you know, it is kind of like the Jokic thing in, as well, you know, it's a guy who looks like a center, but it's not that he's not a center. He just also plays other things.
Yes.
And it's much more, again, about the how does the structure work collectively? So you look at the rest of that Denver team, the fact that Jokic is as good as he is and what he can do is enhanced by, you know, having Jamal Murray, Aaron Gordon, and Michael Porter Jr. with him, where Jamal Murray is not a kind of traditional point guard playmaker type. That's probably his weakness, but he's really good kind of like interchanging with somebody who can do some of that. And Michael Porter Jr. is probably not a guy who you would give the ball to run pick and roll, but if you have other people running pick and roll and he's running off that, that'd be great. And Aaron Gordon is probably someone who wants to do a little more offense than he probably should, and you need to indulge him a little bit, but you don't want to indulge him too much. But then also he's kind of a big man rolling down the lane, and there's sort of like kind of, if you, I always find that when Denver kind of has had injuries, the real sad part is that they've had to, you know, become a more conventional team where like the perfect version of Denver is this sort of structure that just keeps changing, and it only works when all the players are together. But then when the player, I think this is also part of the reason why Nikola Jokic's plus minus is so amazing. I mean, no matter who you have behind him, there's only one Jokic. You know, and the whole structure kind of needs all of what Jokic provides. So, whether you have DeAndre Jordan or Zeke Nagy or DeMarcus Cousins or Mason Plumlee or some of these other guys, like you're never going to get all the things that Jokic provides into that structure. So, yeah, a little long-winded way, but I just think the positionality thing is so interesting.
Let me end on this note, because it's something that Goldsberry grappled with in his book Sprawl Ball, which was, you know, obviously a lot of the same themes about the era. And it was kind of the question of where is this going? Like, where does this top out? Now, this is not a question you really grappled with that much in your book, but I'm curious just where you think, like, is there an upper limit to how many threes per game teams will ultimately take, or that the league will average, or that a team will average? We're up over 40 now. It was, you know, 30 not so long ago. Is there, you know, what do you think about, and again, things that Kirk and others have talked about? Do we need a wider court? Do we need, you know, the 3-point arc to end at the sidelines if we don't widen the court? Do we put in a 4-point line? Where do you think this is all going? And I think his premise a few years ago when that book came out was that the league at some point is going to be forced to react. They're going to have to do something policy wise, because it was exploding that rapidly. What's your view of all this?
My view, first of all, is that I don't think the league should do anything. Like, I disagree with him on that point. You know, I think, just let it play out naturally. I would say that we're probably about at the upper limit of how many threes you're taking. Because if you really think about it, right, there's not too much more space to mine beyond the backcourt line. Like, the backcourt line is kind of a cap for how much a half-court possession can be. Now, there are some interesting things some teams are doing with full-court play. Did you see that play that Boston had against Detroit the other day where, you know, they're doing this thing where they roll the ball up to waste time?
Yeah.
So they did that same thing. And they had like Grant Williams sort of almost like protecting Jason Tatum like he was a center and a quarterback.
Yeah.
And one of the Pistons players kind of came up to Jason Tatum to go get the ball, force him to pick it up. And what happened was Tatum picked the ball up. Grant Williams essentially slipped what looked kind of structurally like a pick and roll from like 75 feet, caught the ball like on the move on a bounce pass. They had a 4-on-3 situation from like 60 feet away, hit a guy in the corner for a three. It looked like kind of Steph to Draymond over like the whole court. It was very strange, but you might get a little bit of that. But no, I don't. I think we're near the upper limit as far as 3-point attempts, and I think I think it's best for the NBA to let this naturally kind of go the way it goes, because what I think is already starting to happen is you're starting to see some teams who look at this as like, it's not that we want to get up more threes, but we want to extend the court. So they're even doing stuff like pinning the opponent in on the baseline, you know, crashing the offensive glass. We talked about Toronto. It's a great example. We haven't talked about Memphis, but I think what they're doing with offensive rebounding and driving is very interesting. What New Orleans is doing when Zion Williamson is healthy, where they are just pounding the paint, and basically they have shooters, obviously, but they want to kind of make you like kind of come all the way in there, and then they're just going to play volleyball on the rim. They're almost kind of pinning you in on the baseline. What the Bucks did a couple years ago with the dunker spot evolution, where they would put a guard like on the baseline underneath the hoop, and that was sort of their change from five out spacing. And so when Giannis would drive to the basket, it would be a lot easier for him to finish because the help defender would be underneath the hoop rather than all the way up where like the Miami Heat players are. I think you're seeing a lot of that. I think you're also going to see a little bit more of just, I mean, I'll blow your mind a little bit more on this. What if offense and defense just aren't separate parts of the game anymore? What if it's just you play a full court game? And what you do on offense is very much dictates what you do on defense. It starts to look almost a little bit more like a hockey game where there's just this constant back and forth and you're positioning. I mean, what if Vivek Ranadive's 4-on-5 idea, like it was ridiculous, but it wasn't that ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, when you started, I thought about it as soon as you were talking about this more, this flowing kind of thing like hockey where everybody's just kind of moving back and forth constantly and you're not all trying to get to one half or the other half for a specific purpose.
Right.
I don't know how that would work if people started trying to force the issue with that and play. I mean, I guess if your four were that great that you could go 4-on-5. I don't know.
The thing you have to think through, though, about this is basketball, like, it's not like the whistle blows after every possession, right? So you get a rebound, and you're already doing this. There are some people who are behind the ball. Some people are in front of the ball. You know,
sure.
Off makes, you're throwing the ball in really quick. You know, it's not like kind of the music stops and then you restart. Like, I just wonder if half-court play in general is just sort of not what's happening. I talk about this in Chapter 5, this idea that what's really happened with pace and space is that there is no fast break, there is no half-court possession, there's just everybody playing faster all the time.
Yeah.
And whatever. So I think you might see some of that. But in general, I would say I don't think that the game will fundamentally change as much over the next 8 years simply because there's just not as much court to mine. You know, you can't go behind the line. And if I were the NBA, I would not add a 4-point line. I think that would solve a problem that doesn't exist, you know, because people would just stand further away and then you'd have the same problem. I would maybe, I mean, if you extended the court for real, like that's an interesting idea, but that's not going to happen because of court side seats.
Yes.
The idea of the arc, like, didn't Kirk say something along the lines of like make the corner three like not a thing anymore?
Yeah, I think that was in there too, basically. That shot was too easy and too much of a payoff for what it was. Something like that.
Yeah. Now the question I would ask is that because it's shorter distance or is that because generally speaking, corner threes are the result of good ball movement and you're more open?
Yeah.
To me, it's probably as much the latter as the former. I have heard like some suggestion that like, what if you made a 3-second violation on corner shooters? So you said you could only stand in the corner. I forget where I heard that.
That's interesting.
That was an interesting idea. I thought where it's like you have like a 3-second violation if you stay in the corner and don't move for more than 3 seconds.
Wow. The PJ Tucker rule.
Yeah, pretty much. That was interesting. But in general, I wouldn't mess with that because what I think would probably end up happening is the guys who are standing in the corner would just stand underneath the basket because that's how they are extending the borders of the court.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'd let it go.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of change over the last 8 years. I think it's best to just kind of let things play out naturally. So I disagree with Kirk on that point.
And the game is in a pretty good place overall. And I, you know, there's probably no need to really tinker at this point. There's not, to your point, there may not be a problem to solve. Like if things really were as homogenous as people were fearing, you know, then that might show up in viewership. And I think that, you know, I think they're still, you know, doing pretty well in that regard.
It's also one last point I'll make is to look back at history, like basketball has always wanted a more open game going back to the beginning of Naismith. I mean, the very fact that we have basketball was as an antidote to football. James Naismith didn't want a roughhouse game. And so I forget who's, I think it might've been like Stuart Soe tells me this all the time. I think it's a really smart way of looking at basketball history. It's like always a battle between the original intent versus like just the nature of competition wanting to be in your face and snarling and physical. And basketball's always been the tension. That's the tension that has persisted throughout the entire history. I mean, we used to have the lane that was 6 feet. They doubled it because George Mikan was too big.
Yeah.
You know, so I in a weird way, I think like this basketball is more in line with what Naismith wanted than almost any other style. I don't know if that should count for anything, but I think it's interesting that we're now saying this is too much when this is kind of almost like basketball has always wanted to be an open game. And now we have it. And it's like, oh, wait, is it too open?
Yeah, no, it's funny too, because yes, it starts with the idea of we're going to put this peach basket up and you shoot the ball and you try to get it in. But then somebody comes up with, well, if I just got to have a taller player than you do and I just stand it down there, like that's right. And so now we're trying to move, like, you know, if we're de-emphasizing size, I mean, it is actually better for the game because it means that more people have a bigger impact collectively, mm-hmm. right? Or more guys can have an impact. And that does go to kind of the spirit of what he originally invented. So anyway, all great stuff. Mike Prater, I've kept you much longer than we intended, but this is a phenomenal discussion. The book, again, is Spaced Out. You can go find it at all the usual places, including in my bookcase where there are 17 copies and counting. I think 5 more arrived while we were taping. Mike, this has been great. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Hey, thanks for having me, and I appreciate all the support and all the great work that you do at SI and elsewhere.
You as well, my friend. We'll see you soon. Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Mike Prada. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter, at Howard Beck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.